Cindy, let's get an intro. What are you doing?
What's it? Where's that?
You're
intro?
Over there just working away.
Cindy,
like a little elf.
An introduction.
Elvish, she's got the elvish, elvish look about her.
Elvish?
Elvish.
Elvis.
Elvis.
You look like Elvis.
Elvis-ish.
Elvish.
Elvish Presley.
Give me a fried peanut butter banana sandwich, man.
I ain't going to no Mordor, man.
The bones of New York. 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 The bones of old 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 New York.
Welcome back to another episode of the Bones of Old New York, Carmine Street Guitars Podcast. My name is Cindy Hulage, and I'm sitting here with, oh, you know what? I'm gonna call you this today.
Okay.
It's St. Patty's Day, right? I have to say hi to Aaron O'Brien, who calls Rick Big Daddy.
How could you be more Irish than Aaron O'Brien?
So we're sitting here with Big Daddy, Boss Man Rick Kelly, our producer and sound man Mike the Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
And
how
one
are
ya? One of my favorite people and dearest friends, Vice President of the New York Academy of Art. Right? Yes?
That's currently true. It is currently the case.
Critically acclaimed author.
Biographer.
Yeah. Amazing writer who did a piece on me in Guitar Connoisseur magazine this past fall.
All true.
It's really exciting. And Rickenbacker fan, but... Not as much as he loves us.
It's Rickenbacker. There's no Bachers.
Rickenbacker.
Yeah.
Rickenbacker.
Correct.
Absolutely. Rick. New York explanation.
There are no Bachers.
Dr. Gregory Allen Thorne, very high.
It's such a privilege to be here at the belly button of New York City.
Well, Carmine
Street
Guitars.
Yeah, it's the center of the universe.
42.
Hitchhiker's Guide to Carmine Street.
Absolutely, definitely. Love the Douglas Adams reference. Take it whenever I can get it.
I want to kind of know how you found Carmine Street and what I don't remember the first time that you came. I think it was before I was here.
No, you were here.
That was the first time.
You were the first
time
I had happened by here. It would have been 2014. And I had a habit of, my job was incredibly stressful at the time. And if I ever could escape, I would, you know, go wandering around, you know, record shops. And I knew about this place because I knew about the Bob Dylan guitar. I had seen reference to it, and I had read that there was a, wasn't there a New York Times story?
Yes. Yeah. It was in the pictures and all.
So
yeah.
I wanted to find where that was, but it wasn't easy to, because I couldn't find the New York Times article. But then I just happened to be kind of like monkishly, you know, ambling around the neighborhood here. And I saw, I think at the time, the Bob Dylan guitar photo was in the window.
Yeah.
Would that have been true?
Am yes, I they're remembering? Still in the window, but now the window's covered.
It's still in the window.
It's still in the window. You can barely see it now. It's faded so much.
All these years later. So I wandered in, and there was Cindy, and she was sweet as pie. Could not have been nicer.
When am I not?
And I remember that there were, now this is also a memory, I remember that there were, in that case over there, some very cheap, like, almost like Masonite-type tellies. They were like $100.
Right.
And I said, what's the deal with those? Now, what was the deal?
Yeah.
And Cindy explained.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rick.
Well, I used to call them the Yang Tellies because it was a couple of guys, investors, that wanted to have me design a guitar that they could sell here in the store and around the, you know, distribute them. And so I came up, at the time I was selling a lot of Jerry Jones guitars.
Yeah.
which were the only guy that was really copying Dan Electro guitars from the 1950s. And so I designed a Tele that was Masonite top and back, just like Ned Daniels had done in the 1950s with the Dan Electro, and the three lipstick pickups. And then, wouldn't you know, like within 2 months, Dan Electro comes back in business again after 40 years of being out of business. And now I have 350 of these copies of Dan Electro's to sell. So
good. I forgot about that timing.
So actually, I just became a Dan Electro dealer, and I was selling tons of those as well as some of mine. But then I wound up with the Bowery Pine thing and wanted to use the shelf space that all these guitars were taken up to store wood on. So I started just offing them for the price we paid for them in the beginning. And that's what happened. And now they're all gone, except for two. I have two left in the store.
And Rick also has the original, the prototype.
Yeah, the prototype. Which is really cool. Yeah, which we just posted down at the great little park, Hudson River Park.
That's actually how I heard of you, too. Because Carter Logan from Squirrel had one of those guitars.
Yeah,
and
Jim bought one, and then he bought one for Tom Waits and a whole bunch of crazy.
Right.
I couldn't believe one day Alan Woody bought one from me, and he says, come to the show tonight, you know. So I said, all right. So I go down to the Wetlands at the time, down in Tribeca, and I hear this. He was playing in a band called Blue Floyd at the time. It wasn't the Government Mule Band, and it wasn't the Allman Brothers. But it was a combination of Pink Floyd members and then him on guitar instead of bass. So I hear the guitar and it's blasting along, and I'm going, no way that could be that guitar. So I get closer and closer to the stage, and sure enough, it's one of those guitars.
Are you serious?
And Alan Woody's burning up these leads at the Wetlands. Yeah, that was awesome to see that. Yeah.
So cool.
That was my first foray here into the shop. It was a strange, wondrous initial encounter. I don't think I met Rick that first time.
I was just out there yapping away.
It seemed like you were maybe sort of like, this was like a sanctuary back here. You know, it was like you were being...
the wall and the door kind of
communing with God
it.
Or something back here.
I always do back here.
And now you have this, lofty perch here. You should describe what we're looking at here in the shop. There is this, shrine built to Rick Kelly. Where he ascends.
That's perfect.
Every day there is an ascension.
Ascension, I rise from the dead.
While I'm working over there, I just happen to get hit in the head with a couple things every few times a day.
Yeah, it puts you at a disadvantage for sure, Cindy.
So I want to talk about your daughter, Kate Thornberry. Yeah. And she's coming out with her first LP, you said?
Well, she's going into the studio this weekend to record her first LP. Mm. Kate Thornberry is my 20-year-old daughter who is a crackerjack songwriter and a badass little boogie-woogie blues guitar player. And she grew up always being around music. She grew up in Jackson, Tennessee, where I lived for, a month of Sundays. Mm. And she was around musicians like Carl Perkins' son, who I was in a band with, and people that had played at the Grand Ole Opry. And there was just, in Tennessee, that we were on Music Highway.
Wow, yeah.
There was just, we would go to Nashville and she would, she would meet people in the country music scene. So she just grew up around, music. And then when she was about 10 years old, she was like, Dad, I want to learn how to play guitar too. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, there's a wall of guitars over there, pick one up. And so she started taking lessons and she just, has been on this trajectory. And last year, she was home. It was, height of the pandemic. And she had sent me this song that she had written called In Vertigo, which got renamed American Dream. But I said, Kate, this is a good song. Mm. Like, I mean, I, you know, you're my kid, but this is a good song. So I said, why don't you, when you come visit, let's get you a studio. And Jeremy McDonald, who's an engineer who works with Sufjan Stevens, got together with her, and basically the two of them and a drummer just banged out this three, you know, song LP in 2 days. I couldn't believe the speed with which she worked. I mean, she was just like cold-blooded. I mean, she just, you know, would, she would go in, she'd play the guitar, tracks, you know, she would, Jeremy's an expert bassist and did keys, and they had like a rough mix by the end of that second day, and then she went back to the West Coast to a studio, and a friend of mine who runs Wavelength Studios in Portland was going to mix it and also like add in background vocals and lead guitar parts. So I knew the day that she was going down and when she was supposed to arrive. So a couple hours after that, I texted Jason Carter, who's the producer, and said, how's Kate doing? He said, she's gone. I said, what do you mean she's gone? It's only been like 2 or 3 hours. He said, she came in, plugged in her guitar, dimed out this Marshall stack, played the solo one time. It was perfect. Whoa. And we just like, you know.
She's
so
a natural.
She's a natural.
Yeah.
And she can play. She Sydney was at the opening for the this club in Soho.
Oh,
and
gosh.
She played there. And there were all these fashionistas and influencers and very intimidating looking people wandering around. And she just, you know. So she's great. And she's playing in a festival this summer with Wilco and The National and Sharon Von Etten and in Oslo, Norway.
Wow.
And she's going into the studio this weekend at this place called Sonic Ranch, where it's kind of an innovative idea where they fly down like pro musicians and they're all in one place at one time for like 5 days. And they can just... It's like the Wrecking Crew times two. And they just motor through things. So she's going down there with her guitar and they're going to knock out, you know, they think they can knock out 6 or 7 songs while they're down there. So
and
she'll have a record.
Say, like, I have a hard time with female vocals sometimes and I absolutely love her voice.
Yeah, she's got a great voice. She's a real natural. I mean, the first time I would have never known that she just started. She sounded like she'd been doing that for years.
Yeah.
And the quality of the song that she wrote was so good. You know, it was like, oh, this girl's got a hit right here.
Recently
thank you, Rick. That's
too,
so nice.
Like,
she's got a there's a maturity and a sadness to the to her songwriting that I think belies her ears and maybe her ears. Anyway, I'm a big fan, Kate Thornbury. Check her out wherever you get your music.
Cool. We'll play some of her music if you give me some.
Absolutely, definitely, for sure.
So wait, I want to circle back. You said you played in a band with Carl Perkins' son.
Yeah, Stan Perkins.
So what band was this? What's the story behind that?
Well, there were a couple of different iterations of it. I actually met Stan in my erstwhile days as a Christian, which I can't say exactly in there anymore, but Stan was I was asked to play lead guitar in this. It was a mega church, and you know, so it was like playing in front of 3,000 people every weekend, but it is like it sounds like U2 all the time, kind of, you know, that kind of music.
And it wasn't that there was that Netflix doc about that.
Exactly.
Do you know what it was, that church?
No, it wasn't Hillsong. Yes. It's like that.
Or it that's was, in Franklin, I think, right?
Yes. Oh, no, that's the way down. That's Gwen Shamblin thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's they're all of the same, you know, cloth.
Were you playing Christian rock?
Yeah, it was Christian rock.
Oh, wow.
Couple Striper covers.
I mean, basically, but not really. It's a weird, very weird genre. But the guy on the acoustic guitar was Stan Perkins, and he had sort of taken up his father's legacy after Carl died in 1998. Yeah. And I knew who Stan was because I had seen Carl Perkins in concert before, and Stan was the drummer.
Oh, wow.
He was the drummer for Carl Perkins. Mm-hmm. And then when his dad died, he was like, I'm going to have to learn how to play guitar. So we played together in the church. And then I told Stan, I said, why don't we put a band together that you would front and I can sing backup vocals and play lead guitar. Stan played acoustic guitar. And what we'll do is we'll do a journey on the life of Carl Perkins.
Wow, great idea.
And I'll, in between songs, I'll interview you and then how he became, you know, the a major inspiration for the Beatles, particularly George Harrison, who in their Hamburg days, he called himself Carl Harrison because he was such a big Carl Perkins fan. So, yeah, we did shows along those lines. It was like a mixture of Carl Perkins and Beatles songs because, you know, one of the great stories is that Carl Perkins was playing a gig in Dyersburg, Tennessee one night. Is anybody interested in this?
Yeah, yeah.
He's a legend. He's the godfather of rock.
Absolutely.
If you're not interested in this, shame on you.
Yeah, really.
But I think if somebody's listening to this podcast, they would.
They're interested in guitar. They're interested in guitar stuff.
Okay. Yeah. They would know who he is.
And... Okay, all right. It is the Carmine Street Guitars. That is what I'm on right now.
This is the one you're on.
So he was playing this, he was playing a gig, this is like in, I don't know, maybe 1960.
Wow.
You know, he had had the car accident, which put him out of commission. So he had Blue Suede Shoes, which was the first song that ever hit country, rock and roll. Rhythm and blues charts number one at the same time.
Free to get ready now, go cat go, but don't you step on my blues.
Elvis never went to number one with Blue Suede Shoes, but Carl did. And then he had a horrible car accident, and he was recovering. And then he was playing a show, and he finished, and it was a hot summer night, and his finger went back into a bladed fan and, like, chopped up his pinky finger and some of the next finger to it.
Whoa.
So... when you see Carl Perkins play, he was having to really only use two or three fingers. So he didn't know that there was such a thing as reverb when he was listening to Les Paul, so he would double pick everything. And that's how that rockabilly sound came about, is he was creating his own reverb by doing it.
Double picking
twice with his fingers.
So he would go like, duh, duh.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah, you know, when he listened to Les Paul and Mary Ford, he was like, this is amazing. Mm. And you can see that technique I could tell Carl Perkins stories all day. I won't. But if you watch, there was a special on Cinemax in the mid-1980s where it's Carl Perkins and friends, and it's Eric Clapton and the guys from the Stray Cats and Dave Edmunds and Ringo Starr, and then, I believe Roseanne Cash is in there, but the coup de grace is George Harrison comes out and plays with him.
Yeah.
And it's the first time George Harrison had played live in forever, and it's magical. But Carl Perkins plays that Les Paul and Mary Ford song, Waiting for the Sun. Right. And he does that, and he does that double picking thing without reverb.
Wow.
And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Just straight into the amp.
Wow, that's magic stuff.
That's
what year was that?
1985.
85, that's right.
Yeah. I have one more Carl Perkins song.
Yeah,
or
please,
story. One more.
Let's hear it.
It's the only time Carl Perkins ever upstaged Elvis. They were, you know, that famous tour where he was Carl, Johnny Cash, and Elvis were on tour together in 1955.
Yeah.
They were playing again some little town in Tennessee, and Carl had that. Is it the Four Tops or is it the Platters that did "Only You Can Make Me Feel So Much"? So he was going to do that song that night, and Elvis, he found out that Elvis was also going to be playing it in his set, and Carl went on first, and he played that song, and it brought the house down. People just had like a magnetic, overwhelming reaction to Carl playing "Only You."
Yeah.
And then, of course, the main attraction is Elvis. So when he comes on, he starts singing "Only You," and the crowd starts chanting, "Bring back Carl." And Elvis loved that.
He did. Eh?
Elvis loved that. He was like, you know, he's like, and so Elvis brought Carl back on.
That's great. They did it together?
They did it together, yeah.
Wow, that's classic.
Wow. Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah. I'm done with my Carl Perkins stories. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram if you want to.
I'll tell you many more.
Hashtag Carl Perkins
me anywhere.
Stories.
Yeah, so we did that sort of, you know, we had that band, and I would interview Stan, and it was pretty great.
Do you have recordings of it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
Yeah.
I will take those.
What did you call
They're somewhere.
Yourselves?
There's somewhere, and we filmed it too. I mean, some of it's on YouTube, I think, still.
What did you call yourself?
Miscellany.
Miscellany.
It was Stan Perkins with Miscellany. I just like the play on the word miscellaneous.
Miscellaneous, yeah.
Yeah.
Sand all over your feet, but yeah, honey dog, honey dog.
Not a great name for a band, but it is what it is, or it was what it was. Yeah.
How'd you get into guitar?
My dad. My dad is a really great multi-instrumentalist, and can play like Mickey Gilley style honky tonk piano. He was a pastor. So the church thing was not an option for me for a long time. And he was the perfect picture of a country parson, adorned with all the virtues of Christian. But then when he was at home, he was like a total goofball, you know, not a very officious religious type. And we weren't allowed to listen to rock and roll except for Elvis. We had one Elvis record. He loved old-timey country music. But he played folk-style guitar, like when it was all the rage in the 60s. Everybody wanted to learn how to play like Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Like that Greenwich Village.
Mm, yeah.
And so we had every Peter, Paul, and Mary record. We had every Kingston Trio record, you know. And so I grew up listening to that. So I said, "Dad, I want to learn how to play guitar." And he said, "I will teach you up until this, he had a book. It was the Laura Weber. She was like the Bob Ross of music.
Music, yeah, with basic books.
Yeah. You remember Laura? Yeah, sure. She had a PBS TV show in which she taught folk style guitar.
Yeah. I don't think I ever seen that before.
Mostly on classical guitar.
It was classical.
Everybody used classical guitar.
It was a classical guitar.
Yeah.
Totally always. Classical. I learned on a classical guitar.
Yep.
And he said, the fifth lesson is the rumba strum. And if you can do the rumba strum, you'll be able to play guitar. But if you can't, it means you don't have rhythm and give up now. And the rumba strum was and so the song was here, there, and everywhere is Mary Ann down by the seashore, sit in the sand. Yeah. And so I followed the dad, you know, like demonstrated it for me one time. And he said, okay, now the rest of it's in the book. So when I was eight, when I had the rumba strum, he was like, okay, you can play guitar.
That's great.
Bless you. And
yeah, and then I was on my, and then I was on my way. And then I found other teachers and, you know,
yeah.
I wanted to play rock and roll, which was verboten for a long time, but had to hide my electric guitar.
Yeah, I was going to say, when did the electric guitar come in?
Yeah, what was the first one, too?
It was a Squire. It was a Squire Stratocaster. It was black Squire Stratocaster. Nice. With it was the one that had it said Fender on the headstock, but by Squire.
By Squire in a little tiny
in letters. A little tiny thing on it.
Yeah.
And
good marketing strategy.
Very good marketing, yeah. Because, you know, it could say I had a Fender Stratocaster, yeah, sure. But it was really not a Fender Stratocaster. But it was good enough for for me, you know. Yeah.
What other guitars did you have, and how'd you get into Rickenbacker?
Oh my gosh, when I was in, I was going through graduate school. I went to a seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. I studied at Oxford University. I didn't pay much attention to guitar while I was in graduate school. I kind of let it go by the wayside.
Were you in theology or?
Theology and philosophy, but my major was philosophy.
Oh, that was mine too, but undergrad.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Were you interested in like the modern stuff, or was it ancient, or was it, you know?
I like the modern better, but—
The existentialist?
I went to a Jesuit school, so there was a lot of like, you know, the problem of like the soul, the mind-body problem that we talked about.
Yes.
This is all nerdy stuff.
You know, yes. Which Jesuit school?
St. Joe's in Philly.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So my thesis was in philosophy of mind, but I loved like, got more into like the Frankfurt group and stuff like that.
Oh, you know? We should all talk. That oh, stuff my gosh. Was, we should have drinks.
I love, yeah, we
oh,
should.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I'm a Theodore Adorno and Max Horkheimer.
Walter Benjamin,
and
all that
Benjamin
stuff.
Benjamin and yeah. That whole, oh, my gosh, I love it.
Yeah, that was all great. Like, it was like I took a class that was.
Sorry, guys.
We're having
a moment here.
It's okay.
Philosophical aside. It was like Dostoevsky, Nietzsche and Kierkegaard class.
Yeah.
And that was like my first exposure to like the out of philosophy 101. And,
yes.
And I was just like, whoa, this is it. I was a history major. I changed my major after that class.
So cool. Wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. So when I got out of graduate school, I mean, I had had like, you know, I had, by that point I had gotten, a regular Fender Tele, and I had a Washburn Jumbo acoustic. But then when I moved to Tennessee, it was like guitar heaven.
Sure.
I mean, everywhere I went, you'd throw a rock in any general direction and hit a decent guitar player. And so I was just like, I really want to learn how to play really well. Oh.
Where? Time
out. It's okay. We're off to interrupt it by a guest.
Okay.
A surprise guest.
That's one of the elements of this that would make it so exciting.
Yep.
You never know who's going to wander in.
Somebody has a package.
Oh, no, that's
somebody.
My glasses. How you doing,
like,
buddy?
You look like you're straight from Metallica.
Yeah. This is James.
There you are.
Hey,
hello. Hello.
Yeah, this is James.
How are you? We're just recording a little podcast here.
I didn't
how you doing?
Bring enough of you guys here, but I got one for Rick.
Awesome. All right, thank you, buddy.
If I looks like you the were here,
my gosh. You just look like the spirit of St. Patrick.
Yes, St. Patty's Day.
Wonderful.
There are a couple of new Irish jokes I've never heard before. This is an old one. This is the first one now. Is anybody here Irish?
Yes. Yeah, me.
Okay, I'll tell
him.
Okay.
Wait, can you tell us who you are and what you're doing?
Santa. My name is Jim. Jim, I brought Wood over here from 620 Broadway.
620 Broadway.
That's what we built the lot.
Rick built the guitar and Cindy's before. Decorating it. And I'm,
yeah.
It's fantastic.
The Rotten things. Hoof, that's right behind that one, right?
Anyway, I got some Irish jokes, but first, is anybody Irish?
Yes.
Okay, I'll tell them slowly. You know what an Irish cannoli is?
What's that?
A Twinkie.
A Twinkie. Oh, my God. That were good.
You know why there are no female Irish carpenters?
What's that?
Because they've been led to believe that this is 6 inches. What has a head and a tail, is 3 miles long, and has an asshole every 2 feet. St. Patrick's Day Parade. What is Irish foreplay?
What's that?
Brace yourself, Bridget. And you really have to be Irish to get this one. So you Irish will know. I got my green on today.
Yep.
How can you tell which one is the bride at an Irish wedding?
How's that?
She's the one kissing the golden retriever. You know, never kiss an Irishman.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Anywho, those are some ones. Of them.
Yep.
You know why they're not? Like, these are old ones. You know why there's no Irish attorneys?
What's that?
They can't pass the bar.
He'll be here all week, ladies and gentlemen. Muy divertissimo.
Thanks
for all the work.
Thank you, buddy. I'll send them to you later.
Who is that?
He gave us wood from 620 Broadway. 620 Broadway is an awesome little building.
Place there.
He's a friend, just a friend of the store.
Yeah, he saw the documentary and wanted to give us wood from the building.
Strap body up there.
Oh, cool.
The one that's like
deconstructed.
Basically.
Yeah. Cool.
So back to the
Rickenbacker.
Yes, back to the Rickenbacker.
Well, it just seemed to me like you either had to be a Gretsch guy or a Rickenbacker guy.
The Beatles and everybody.
You know?
Yeah.
So I got a Rickenbacker 330, and that's the one I played when I would play with Stan. So he would say, "Go, cat, go!" Yeah, play maybe later the song I'll play is Honey Don't.
Oh yeah, great nice. One. Best, I think it's the best one. Best Carl Perkins.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Beatles did a great version of it, but
Ringo. That was one of the Ringo hits, yeah. So anyway, then I just kinda went down the wormhole on the Rickenbackers, you know. There's something they have a character to them.
Did you get into the Bee Gees with the 12-string sound?
Yes, I have a 12-string Rickenbacker. Mm-hmm. I love it. I was playing it last night, and there's just, I'm a huge Roger McGuinn fan. Mm. By the way, anyone that wants to go, he's playing the Tarrytown Music Hall in June. So if you want to go see Roger McGuinn, he doesn't play a whole lot anymore, but when he does, it's just him and his Martin 12th string. And, yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
Talk about the one that you brought in a little bit. Because what's that?
Oh, that one. Well, that one's, there are very few Rickenbacker acoustic guitars.
That was cool.
Rick was into that.
Yeah, I was into that one. That one was awesome.
They were a very limited run, and they were made by a guy in California who used to build cars. You'd be interested in it. You should get him on the podcast. Hmm. His name's Paul Wilczynski. And he's now living in Italy, but Rickenbacker came up with a design for an acoustic guitar. They had like two or three. And they only did it for like a year or two.
Oh, no kidding.
They didn't make that many of them. And then for a limited time after they did their like factory production run, they gave Paul the rights to make Rickenbacker acoustics after that design.
Did he continue on? He's still making them?
He's mostly a Rickenbacker restore person now. Like he restores Rickenbackers.
Mm-hmm. He's like an authorized.
I don't know what his situation is.
Is he authorized by Rickenbacker?
He was authorized by Rickenbacker to do those guitars. So yeah, that's a rare bird.
Yeah, but what was the story with the finish and all on that? Because you said you custom ordered it.
Yeah, I custom ordered it. I told him, he asked me, you know, what I wanted on the finish. And I said, you know what? I said, let me just give you a theme and then knock yourself out. And he said, nobody ever does this. This is so great. And I said, you know, I love The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. And so when it came back, it was this, blue guitar with this flame burst. And then if you flip it over on the back, you can see like he's like a little scrim swimming up the neck. Mm. Very cool.
Mm. That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
Nice, that is a beauty. I like that one a lot.
But Rick saved it because I wasn't paying attention for other reasons in January, and it got all dried out. And then Rick, you know, like did his voodoo magic and brought the neck back to life. Thank you, Rick.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Yeah. So that's my story with the Rickenbackers. Now I have.
So cool.
Way too many Rickenbackers. But now, I think I need a Cindy or a Telecaster or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I think you do, too.
I think so.
You and Kate.
I think I need to get rid of some of my guitars, and I need to de-own and be
You need that Bowery Pine. Everybody needs that Bowery Pine.
Yeah, because you know what? I was, in the first episode, I was listening to... you all had explained this to me before, but the stability of the pine neck is something that I never really appreciated until you started talking about that, about why you don't have to have a truss rod in order to have a guitar neck that, you know, stays and plays great.
And it doesn't ever move, and it doesn't have a rod down the middle of it or a channel, open channel. It's just the solid piece of wood that it was meant to be.
I have to say that's the reason why I wound up getting rid of my Gibsons. I used to have a lot of Gibsons, but I just was constantly, they were, you know, the...
Always moving.
Moving. Yeah. And I was just like, it just wound up being a nightmare.
I mean, a lot of people think because maple is so much harder wood, it's a hard wood, it's such much more stable. But it's really not. It actually has to bend to get through the canopy, to get to the sunlight, and the cells in the wood are very malleable. And it has to have a truss rod because it is always moving. It's going this way, it's going that way. Especially on a slab cut, which is most Fender necks, a slab cut. And if you don't let that stuff season out for at least a couple of years, it's going to move too much.
Well, I definitely noticed that. I had this Elliott Easton SG that was kind of my pride and joy, but I felt like every time I took it out of the case, it needed an adjustment.
Well, the SGs are notorious.
Wait. Okay,
Rick's
now.
Rick's got a whole thing.
Everybody, can you talk about that? Because that guitar was a nightmare. Yeah.
I love SGs. I'm actually making a couple now. But all it takes is to reinforce the one side of the neck pocket a little bit and make it you know, a little wider and sink the neck a little tiny bit deeper into the body, and it becomes way more stable. But the way they designed that guitar with the neck just perched off the end, it's just a fulcrum action that just makes the thing bend so much, and it's always going out of tune. If it's warm and you're coming from a cold room into a warm room, it takes 20 minutes for it to start staying in tune. If you're going the opposite way, it does the same thing. It's always moving. You see a lot of them with breaks at the heel. It just shows that's a weak spot. It should be reinforced a little bit. And the same with the truss rod slot on most Gibsons. You know, you look at the Epiphones, they never break headstocks because they use an Allen key in a small slot. You know, Gibson has that big old slot with the big old nut and big old wrench to go around it, and it weakens the headstock so much that they're broke. Most of the ones you see have been broke at least once or twice.
Yeah, we leave a little bit more wood on ours, too, for that reason.
Yeah, just it's a design thing. You have to design it right to begin with. There's a lot of tension on the neck.
And is that why the Les Paul is tilted back, the headstock's tilted back so far?
Well, you know, they actually reduced the angle because in the early days it was tilted so far back that it became very vulnerable. If you fell over backwards, it would break the head because it was under tension and it was steeper than the body and it would actually pop the head off. But then they reduced that angle and it made it a lot more stable. But it was a lot to do with the mahogany they were using then, too. The Honduras mahogany was just a much more stable wood than the Fiji wood that they're using now. That stuff's more like, you know, your door in your suburban house, the little wand, or very soft mahogany.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was always, I mean, obviously it's a very rock and roll shape, but they just seem to be sort of problematic guitars.
Yeah, they move around a lot.
That was the first thing that Rick made fun of me for in the shop when I started here. He asked what I had at home, and that was one of the first guitars that I ended up buying. And I didn't even want an SG originally, but I ended up buying one. And he came in the next day with the Les G idea, which we've only made a few of those for ourselves, really, but... Explain that a little bit, Rick. You just did half and half, and that was kind of part of the reinforcement.
Les Paul was a very bulletproof design, you know, as opposed to the SG with the double cutaway. When you have a single cutaway, you have all that side support. But I always loved the contours on an SG on that, so I just figured I'd combine them and call it a Les G.
They're cool, though.
Very cool. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about what you do now, Greg?
Yeah, well, I'm...
Because it's interesting.
Well,
I'm at the... Yeah, I like the crossover.
I'm at the New York Academy of Art, which is in Tribeca. And it was... it is the byproduct of a time... For those of you that have watched the Warhol Diaries, there's a new documentary on Netflix. There was this... era in the early 1980s in which there was sort of this new group of kids, they called them the kids, that were coming up through Keith Haring, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Kenny Scharf, and, you know, and others, that one of Andy Warhol's friends said, you should start a drawing class. Because the kids don't know how to draw. And Warhol was classically trained. He went to the Carnegie Institute. Oh. So he started a drawing class in the church basement on Lafayette Street. And the first students were Kenny, Keith, and Jean-Michel.
No kid.
And that initiative then became a school of figurative art because, by the 60s and 70s, it was the height of minimalism and abstract art and conceptual art, and nobody was doing figurative work anymore. It was completely passé. Mm-hmm. But then in the 80s, thanks to people like Eric Fischel, who's a friend of Carmine Street Guitars.
I know, there's all these
legends
that way, too.
Francesco Clemente, Julian Schnabel started painting the figure again. And all of a sudden, whammo, it was back. And now it's, you know, the most celebrated rock star painters of this era are people that are I think it was de Kooning who said, you must take the figure and twist it into a strange miracle. And that's what's happening in contemporary art. And it happens at New York Academy of Art, which is now a freestanding private graduate school of figurative art that combines all of the traditional skills going all the way back to the classical period. So it's like medical school. They learn anatomy like a doctor does. Yeah. So they know they have to build écorchés where they know the entire skeletal system and the musculature. And they're like doing countless hours of drawing from life, drawing from nudes, self-portraits. Mm-hmm. And so they have this insane skill. That's the first year of the MFA program. And then the second year of the MFA program, the faculty say, okay, you have this insane skill. Now you've got to fuck it up or you won't be seen in the contemporary art world. Because if you just, you know, if you're going to do, you know, nobody wants to see Caravaggio again.
Right.
You know, you need to find your own voice with it.
You have to have your own visual language. Mm-hmm. So then that's what happens at the end of it. And so the school has really begun churning out these, like, the hot properties in the contemporary art world, like Arkmanoro Niles and Nodeline Pierre and Anna Park and Trey Abdella and so many of the shows right now that are up, Danica Lundy, Liz Glossner, they're graduates of the Academy. And we've kind of become the cool kid on the block now after many years of being very square.
Yeah, but now they know how to draw.
But they know how to draw. And then for the rest of them, you know, for the rest of the graduates, they're always going to have a studio practice. They will, you know, always be in shows. But a lot of our graduates wind up going on to teach then, but, you know, because every college, university, atelier needs people that can teach the basic skills. And so a lot of our graduates teach at places like RISD and, you know, the
Mica,
PAFA, all of us.
Got to put Mica in there.
Well, we have to because, you know, could we just talk a little bit about that while we're on this topic? Rick is a sculptor, is a trained artist, so...
Yeah, I went to Mica back in 1969, and I was there for about three. I went to the sophomore year and ran out of money, and I was actually rebuilding the truck engine of the Reinhardt School of Sculpture. We had some military vehicles because we were a nonprofit art school and got to go to places like Jessup in Jessup, Maryland, which was like a PX base where you could just about buy anything that you would buy in military life. You know, they sold anything you wanted to buy. You could buy a tank or you could buy a Jeep from the 40s. And
you got some cool stuff from there still.
And Reinhardt, the sculpture was a graduate program. And they had, it was an old train station from the 1800s that was converted into the art school. Plus the main building goes back to the 1800s. It's a really old art school. But I majored in sculpture and didn't have any money, so I soon realized that if you don't have money to build up, you know, a portfolio, and making sculpture is very expensive, you know, if you don't have a family to give you money to go buy the bronze and the stainless steel and the materials at the time that was so good. I was just going to Druid Hill State Park and getting logs and carving wood into these crazy drip shapes and stuff.
Hmm.
But yeah, I had a lot of fun there. I learned a lot. It was the best time I ever had in my life being in that. We used to also be able to work all night. We became like the night watchmen of the place, and they would let me and like four other guys in to, you know, watch the place at night, overnight. So we worked all night every night in the studios when there was nobody there. And making sculpture.
Studios are really cool there too. No?
Oh, it's so awesome. Yeah, because it backed up against the railroad track. It was an old train station, and the train still went through under the old shed from the 1800s in the back. It would go in from one tunnel and out the other tunnel, and in between was the station. So we saw all kinds of actual trains that would go through while you were back there carving and stuff. You'd have to move away a little bit from the edge while the trains went through.
It's crazy.
I'll never forget one time, it was during the Vietnam War, And there was a train cars that were full of tanks and jeeps and army vehicles, and they happened to stop in between, you know, where the open shed was. And all the students went out with spray cans and were spraying peace signs on the tanks and on the army vehicles. And then we ran back inside. We always wondered what happened when they wound up at the Air Force base or wherever they were heading.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, speaking of Irish Erin, just real quick, she was here last night. She was flipping out over your drip sculpture out there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, she almost tripped over it because you know where it is. Yeah. She puts it right in the middle of the walkway. But yeah. She was like, she loved it. She had no idea. She's like, he made this? I was like, yeah.
Yeah. I remember going to get the bronze ingots over at Heidelman Bronze in Baltimore. The school I went to is in Baltimore City. And I went over in the Army Jeep, which was, you know, star on the side, 1941 to Willie's Army Jeep. And I'm going across the bridge to get to Heidelman and to pick up the ingots. And I get pulled over by this cop. And I'm going, oh, great, what did I do? So he comes running up. He goes, where did you get this Jeep? I said, oh, it's the school. You know.
You have to put a photo of the Jeep in the show notes.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Right.
Yeah.
That would be very so cool.
Yeah.
But I think that's something I find the most compelling about Cindy Guitars and, you know, and Kelly Guitars is that you can have this, should you choose, a sculptural or a painting dimension to it. There's not, I don't really know of any other guitar builders that have skill as an artist to incorporate into a build, which I think is really unique. Like I'm sure that's, you know, one of the things that, you know, and I've been to shows where Bob Dylan has played that guitar. And it's got an eagle sculpture on it.
Yeah,
you know, it's a sculpture. Yeah. So it's a guitar, but it's also a sculpture, too.
Yeah, everyone's different. They're all hand-carved. Each one comes out a little differently because it's hand-carved.
And did you know Cindy was, you know, a skilled artist when she walked in?
Immediately. When she walked in the door, she told me she had been at Art Students League, and I went, oh, well, that, you know, made a big impression, of course, and was one of the reasons why I had to say, of course, yeah. Because we both that way relate with an art background. And I think it does, you know, it helps in lots of ways as far as designing guitars and knowing what a bad design is and what good designs like that work. Yeah, I mean,
that's a mechanically. Though. Yeah,
that's like, only a mechanically bad design. It's a beautiful design
it's
as far as
visually.
Aesthetically. It's hard to do. Aesthetically, it's hard to make a guitar really balanced properly and have really nice lines. I think Bernardo Rico was one of the best with BC Rich, and his designs were, they just flowed. They were beautiful. They were very Art Nouveau-like. But, you know, when Ovation tried to make a solid body or Martin Guitars tried to make a solid body, it's, you know, I love them now because they're so weird looking and they're so, you know, Gumby-like.
Yeah, we've gone over that a lot. But
Is there an illustration that you've done on a guitar or a wood-burning, Cindy, that you would say this stands out as a favorite or... It's something that would be, you know, someday, you know, when we hope you live a long time and don't die young, but might be in a museum somewhere as an artistic piece. I mean, both of you.
So many good ones she's done.
Oh,
you know,
man.
You know, is there one that sort of stands out that you're like, this is the one that I would say this is the essence of what it meant for me to be a builder, but also a guitar builder, but also an artist?
I mean, I think right now I'd probably have to just go with the cathedral model, but I always feel like there's so much more to do. Mm-hmm. So I can't really.
Well, can you say what the cathedral model is? Have you talked about that on the show already?
No. Yeah.
No. So one day I ended up in the back of St. John the Divine uptown, and I had never seen it before, and I didn't know where I was. So when I came up in the back of that, I went like, what is this? You know, all the old statues and everything, all the old, you know, sort of Gothic, you know,
gargoyles.
Stuff. Yeah, and so I went around and looked at the front of it, and I just went like, oh, man, I got to put this on a guitar face. Like, I got to figure out how I'm going to make a guitar that's, you know, cathedral-themed. And so I was already doing some wood burning at that point. And I had called Rick, and he was like, well, you know, sketch up a body. Maybe we can do something with the horns that kind of match some of the, you know, the peaks on the building and all that. So it's sort of like a double horned, almost, it's a little bit SG-ish, but more of a slab cut for the first one that I did. But we incorporated wooden pickup covers so that I could burn over the pickup covers. Hmm. And it was really kind of based more around the artwork. So that was really the first, I think one of the first ones, that and my Moto guitar, but that didn't have wood burning on it.
That was just leather, the design part,
that was more of an aesthetic thing, but just a kind of a different theme. But I think those two, because they were the first two that really kind of made me go like, oh, I can do whatever I want on a guitar.
Pickpocket Moto Guard. It actually had a zipper on the leather face. It had such a motorcycle vibe. You know, James Dean would have loved this guitar. It had that thing about it. You know, it was all leather faced with zippers and, you
all
know,
black,
studs and little
and
trim
chrome.
With a little metal trim around the inside of the leather. All black. Yeah, it was badass.
Yeah. I don't know. I would think probably picking one of those two right now, but I have so many things planned.
Yet to be done.
I'm starting to get into marquetry a little bit, which is exciting because I do want to do like a cathedral and woodburned version of that. So it's a whole nother level to what that started as.
But if somebody said, I want a guitar that has Tom Waits on it, you could do that, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Cindy could do that. Yeah, I could do
that. Yeah, I've done a lot of portraiture on guitars too.
Well, the guitars she made for Alex. Tons of.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, like some of her best work is like on the Diva guitar.
I was just going to say the Diva had a lot of great portraits on it.
What is the Diva guitar?
Well, the Diva had all
SRV's number one. What's the Diva guitar?
The Diva guitar. We built two acoustic jazz bodies because we wanted a really big guitar to fill it up with divas, you know, in the music industry, basically. And then the other one was the guys that had Roy Orbison and Elvis. And it was just, you know, all these images all the way across it of all the famous rock stars.
Yeah, the girls. What did we have on the girl? We had Debbie Harry.
Yeah, and then the other one was the double gun with all the
modern
electric
gunslinger.
Guitar slinger.
Yeah. He called it.
Yeah, the guitar slinger guitar had just so many images that she did on there.
Amazing.
Yeah, they were incredible.
I forget how much work I've done.
So you should be teaching at the art.
I have to get my portfolio together.
At the academy.
At the academy.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, pyrography class.
Pyrography.
The pyrography class, yeah.
Well, I thought that was kind of a fun crossover, too, because even though we met here, it was really kind of that thing where you invited me to one of your shows there.
Yeah.
And we've been...
Do you have, like, night school... No.
Absolutely. I mean, so
that's where I used to teach at the night. Adult education.
Yes, we have everything from beginner classes all the way up through master classes.
Do that.
No, absolutely, definitely.
And it would be age too. That's
it. Would be totally unique because I don't. I mean, I don't know. I don't know anybody else that's doing that right now.
No, she's bringing it back. You know how many people now are copying her?
I was just talking about this yesterday, and I'm not like, you know, whatever, but I remember when we started posting on Instagram, and I would look at all the pyrography hashtags, I would look at wood burning hashtags, guitar art, all that stuff.
Everything
there
from
was
the 1950s.
Barely anything. Yeah. There was really barely anything, and I've noticed more and more people kind of following us throughout the years, and then it was like, all these different groups that are posting just stuff like that.
You know,
that
it's funny because just before you came in, Alex Streeter, who was a famous jeweler over in my building where I was living, where I'm living now, he had a shop in the basement. He does beautiful, outrageous jewelry. All through the 60s, he became famous. But just before Cindy came here, he wanted to wood burn on the face of his cheap acoustics.
Yeah.
And he did some pretty cool stuff on there, but he was burning like, you know, through the finish.
Yeah.
So
it just melts
and bled and didn't work as good. But that was cool to see that he had that vision, you know, so early. I don't know if he ever did any other ones. But.
So it just became a hunka-hunka burning guitar.
Yeah. It wasn't so bad, so crazy. But
Cindy, would you call yourself a pyroneer?
A pirate on the air.
Good one, Mike.
That's good. I was like, wait, what?
This must be pun day. Yeah. You know, all the Irish jokes. Now there's the puns.
This is so funny. The other cool thing is that we actually have the 57 Great Jones Wood, which is, you should explain a little bit of that because Basquiat, that has that bust. Yeah, but also the 5 points thing because
we were building a 57 Great Jones, little stables back in the 1800s. It was actually stables. And then they figured, well, this is a good place to have an office, a hideout. And that was the crime boss, the first organized crime boss in the late 1800s, John Kelly, whose real name was Vicarelli.
A relative of yours?
Yeah, they always took my name, you know. They always took Kelly, even the Machine Gun Kelly. His name was really Barnes. And he didn't want to destroy his family name, so he chose Kelly. But anyway, he was the crime boss and had his offices in there in the 57 Great Jones. And then Capone had his in later, during the gangster era. But then in the 80s, Andy Warhol bought the building. And he had Michel Basquiat work there, and he did all his work there, lived and died there in that same building. So it's got a great history, and we wound up with a bunch of boards out of that place. I walked out one day, and there was a couple of boards there, and then I said, he's in his truck bringing more wood.
We should do a collaboration with the Basquiat Foundation.
That's what I kept telling Rick. We got to do something
like that. I mean, that would be amazing.
Yeah, we'd have to have more documentary. I mean, this guy was on the construction crew who was doing the work in the building. And I think that was done, you know, I don't know when, but there he just grabbed the wood. It wasn't like there was any record of, okay, this wood came from here. And so we have no proof of the wood actually came out of there other than his word and my word, you know.
But we but the guys that have brought us wood, I mean, even the guy from Trinity Church, he got pictures in the bell tower.
Yeah, well, that was good because he had all. This guy doesn't have that. He was just in a construction company.
Well, it's not a Shroud of Turin situation. I mean, you could probably take the guy's word for it.
Yeah, I think I could do it that way, you know, but I
have a friend that lives in that building, by the way.
Oh, really?
So she might know. She might.
I don't think there's anybody living in it because it's only an apartment. It's one story high. It's only a ground floor.
Okay,
studio.
Maybe it's the building next door.
It might be next door because there's a big apartment building next to it. Yeah.
I got you.
No, I don't like this. No, let's do it again. I hate doing this part.
That's great. You're doing good.
That was good. That was good.
Don't stop. Do it.
Don't stop thinking. Stop thinking.
Yeah, but
and that's the outro.
All right, so you're going to have to get a little recording thing.
You do it. I'm not doing it. You do it.
You know I put a lot of this stuff in.
Thank you. Thank you for notifying me of the time.
Yeah.
Are we done
why don't
here?
You do it, Rick?
Okay,
Rick,
thanks for coming, Gregory.
Hey, wait. All right. Everybody, settle. Okay, now.
Thanks for coming, Gregory. Thanks for being part of our podcast today on St. Paddy's Day. Anything else you want to tell us about as you're heading back to the academy?
Well, I am also a rock and roll biographer. I wrote a book for Random House that got New Yorker Review, New York Times Review. On an obscure Jesus freak named Larry Norman, who was the started Christian rock back in the late 60s when he was on Capitol Records, and huge inspiration on Bono and Black Francis from Pixies and all these people who are relevant today.
Is in print now?
It's in print, Random House, and it's called copy. Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music?
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, Crossroads.
Yeah, that's right. So available wherever you find books. But I will bring you a signed copy the next time I come back, Rick.
Yeah. All right.
Awesome. That's for me.
In your ear. Podcast Network.